for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
the headlines. Assassinated Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh will be laid to rest in Qatar later on Friday. Top U.S. security official says the Iranian leader's promise of revenge for Haniyeh must be taken seriously. And more civilians are killed in Israel's attacks on Gaza, where the total death toll from the war nears 39,500. Hello and welcome to your world news, coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated by Israel 2 days ago, will be laid to rest in Qatar later today. Haniyeh's funeral prayer is set to be held at a mosque in the Qatari capital, Doha. He will then be buried at a cemetery in the city of Lusail, north of Doha. Haniyeh's body arrived in Qatar on Thursday from the Iranian capital. Earlier that day, thousands gathered in Tehran for a massive funeral procession and prayer service that was led by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Haniyeh was assassinated in his accommodation in northern Tehran in the early hours of Wednesday. He was in Iran for the inauguration of President Masoud Pezeshkian.
The funeral of Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh commenced with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leading the funeral prayers. Iranian and Hamas political figures, along with mourners, come together in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to take part in the ceremony. Politicians and citizens alike called for justice, assuring that the Israeli assassination would not go unavenged.
Another mistake of the Zionist regime is that they do not pay attention to the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. If the enemy attacks, they shall receive counterattacks. We have shown this through time.
Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh was killed in a strike on his residence in Tehran on Wednesday. The Israeli crime, along with the green light from the United States, escalated tensions in the West Asia region. In Haniyeh's funeral, people said the path of resistance will be followed stronger than ever, and that they continue to uphold the principles that the Hamas leader championed.
Today we say goodbye to our leader Ismail Haniyeh, the one whom the Zionist regime thought that by assassinating him it could divert our path, or weaken our will, or reduce our efforts. By committing this new crime, the Zionist regime has shown the whole world that it is the manifestation of evil in the region. The whole world now should work together to eradicate this cancer.
Iranians from across the country converge in the capital to take part in Ismail Haniyeh's funeral and a display of unity with the people in Gaza, an untrammeled support for the Palestinian cause.
We came today to support the people of Gaza and say that we are with you until the end. With the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh, the resistance will only become stronger. Hopefully, this genocide in Gaza will end soon.
I have come to show solidarity with the people of Gaza. God willing, they will be the victors. God willing, with resistance and patience, Israel will soon be destroyed.
The Iranian capital witnessed large crowds of mourners who came together to pay their support and bid farewell to martyr Ismail Haniyeh and pledge their support for the Palestinian cause. Reza Hashemi, Tehran.
The White House National Security Advisor John Kirby says the recent warning by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei regarding the revenge for the assassination of Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh must be taken seriously. In a televised interview, Kirby said Tehran has already proven that it is able and willing to carry out major attacks against Israel. He also noted that the U.S. will implement all necessary precautions to ensure the defense of itself and its allies in the region. On Wednesday, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei issued a stern warning to Israel, promising a harsh response for Haniyeh's assassination. He emphasized that Iran considers it a duty to avenge the blood of the Hamas leader who was martyred on Iranian territory. Now, Israel assassinated the Hamas political bureau chief and a senior Hezbollah commander in a matter of hours amidst its genocidal war on Palestinian people. Regional resistance groups, which acted in coordination in recent months in the face of the Gaza genocide, have vowed retaliation. Israel's assassinations and the possible response by the axis of resistance were the topics of our explainer program.
When it comes to targeted assassinations, the Israeli regime leads the pack. But why has Israel resorted to this terroristic act, which is against international law? And why did Israel decide to carry out two targeted assassinations in a matter of 48 hours, knowing that it would face a retaliation which may include all or some of the resistance groups in West Asia? Well, it's worth first taking a look at the resistance groups and countries in the West Asia region. You're looking at the three major ones, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, of which they are hosting these resistance groups, like Lebanon hosting Hezbollah, Syria, home to the National Defense Forces, and then Yemen hosts the Ansarullah movements. In terms of Palestinian resistance groups, well, there are four major ones. Let's name them, as you're seeing here, Kataib Ezzedin Rassam. Also, you have Hamas, which is the one that at this point very much covered in the news. Iraq is another country that is host to many resistance groups. There's 18 of them that are active, some of which you are seeing here, such as Hashd al-Shaabi, Islamic Resistance of Iraq, to name a couple. Now, a word on Iraq. Following the assassination of martyr Haj Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis by the U.S., 18 new Iraqi resistance groups, as mentioned, emerged to fight the U.S. occupation of Iraq. These groups are all active, ready to act against the U.S. occupation forces. You're seeing some of these groups' logos in this particular snapshot. The groups have carried on an average of 250 attacks, as you see there, against U.S. troops and U.S. interests. Now, these countries and groups combined form what's called the Axis of Resistance. You're going to see the outline here. The boxes here show some of those groups that are part of this Axis of Resistance, all to have worked against not only the Israeli regime, but also against the U.S. presence on their soil, which has led to the instability in various countries. For example, U.S. and Syria, they're there illegally stealing its oil at the same time. Well, a quick review of the events over a 48-hour period, it points to the fact that there's a level of coordination that actually took place between the U.S. and the Israeli regime. From what we're seeing here, not only were there assassinations, for example, in Beirut and in the Islamic Republic, Beirut being there, the U.S. also carried out attacks in Iraq on a base belonging to Hashd al-Shaabi that you see over here, killing four members of the group there. There are reports that one U.S. Force was also killed. There was also an attack that happened inside of Syria by the Israeli regime. Let's not forget the patience that Iran has exercised since Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Through almost 10 months of this genocide, Iran and the resistance groups have struck a balance that put pressure on the Israel regime, with resistance groups sharply increasing attacks while avoiding an all-out war. Examples of these attacks have come from, for example, Yemen, the Islamic resistance in Iraq, and more recently, joint operations between the two against the Israeli regime, such as on the port of Haifa and even Tel Aviv itself. Now, in April, Iran executed its biggest attack on Israel, the first ever attack on the Israeli regime and the occupied land directly, the name Operation True Promise, which I'm sure you heard of. Hundreds of missiles and drones were launched in retaliation for an Israeli strike that happened on Iran's embassy compound that killed some Iranian military commanders in Damascus, Syria. Operation True Promise, well, it involved these missiles and drones and rockets. Let's not forget hypersonic ones also, which hit targets with pinpoint accuracy. Now, let's take a look at what we're going to maybe see. Not maybe. At this point, it's almost confirmed, if not 100% confirmed, that there is going to be retaliation coming from Iran. Iran's leader, based on an article by the New York Times, reportedly based on some sources that they didn't want to name, has attacked an order on Israel. This happened yesterday in terms of the news that the New York Times reported. It's unclear how forcefully Iran is going to respond. Perhaps it's going to be another combination attack of drones and missiles like Operation True Promise, or maybe on military targets close to Tel Aviv and Haifa so the regime can feel the wrath that it's going to have coming. Will Iran target civilian targets? Well, at this point, that's anybody's guess. The other option, if not a do-it-alone, would be a coordinated attack involving Iran and other resistance forces like from Yemen, Syria, and Iraq in order to get maximum effect and damage. The reason this may be the go-to scenario is that the U.S. has also struck Hashd al-Shaabi. If the axis of resistance doesn't respond in some way, it would jeopardize the purpose of the alliance in some way. And this is what Iran has in its arsenal. It's good to take a look at that in terms of ballistic missiles, 3,000 to 5,000, including hypersonic ones. You're also looking at drones, 10 models of that. And then in terms of the army itself, could be as high as 700 to 800,000, of which you have about 500,000 of them on active duty. When you put all that together, along with the missile capabilities and the fighters of the resistance groups, an all-out military attack against the Israeli regime, well, for the regime and the U.S., is not going to be a walk in the park, and that's something they need to watch out for.
Now, people in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, have bid their farewell to the Hezbollah military commander, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike on Tuesday. During the funeral ceremony of Shukr, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah vowed that the Lebanese resistance movement will avenge Israel's killing of its commander. Our correspondent in Beirut, Maram Saleh, reports.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has described as inevitable the retaliation for Israel's killing of the Lebanese movement's top commander, Fuad Shukr.
The enemy and those who are behind it must await our inevitable response. There's no doubt in this regard. The upcoming days and nights, as well as the battlefield, will prove we are working on a real and very calculated response.
During the funeral ceremony of Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr, who was killed in an Israeli strike on a residential building in a Beirut suburb, Nasrallah underlined that Israel has seriously crossed the red lines. The Hezbollah chief added that the region has entered a new era following the assassination of both Fuad Shukr and head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, in Tehran. Nasrallah's words resonated strongly among the supporters of the resistance in Lebanon.
We are with the resistance and stand by the resistance. We are the people of the resistance, and this Israeli aggression is not new for us. We're all ready to be martyred.
They are foolish if they think they can weaken our resistance by assassinating our leaders. These assassinations make us stronger. Even if they kill us all, we will not forsake Gaza and the Palestinian cause.
God willing, the oppressors will be punished, and we have full trust in the leadership of the resistance.
The families of the martyrs told Press TV that they're resolved to continue the path of resistance.
We give this gift to the martyrs in Palestine and the children of Palestine and the women of Palestine. Our cause is one. It is the cause of every human being for the sake of humanity and against the enemies of humanity.
Despite the martyrdom of our men from the early years of resistance until now, this movement has become stronger. We will defeat the enemies, Israel and the U.S., thanks to the blood of our martyrs.
The assassination of Hezbollah's commander is expected to set off a new phase of resistance operations, which would show the capabilities of the Lebanese resistance group in the face of Israel's intensified aggression.
The leader of the Lebanese resistance has vowed retaliation for the assassination of top military commander Fuad Shamas. Previous assassinations of Hezbollah commanders has not hindered the movement's determination. So this incident could perhaps make it even more steadfast and powerful. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
It is nearly 10 months into the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The regime continues to pound the Palestinian territory with more airstrikes and artillery fire. In one of the latest attacks, at least three people were killed in Israeli bombings of a residential building in central Gaza. Several people were also injured. Elsewhere in central Gaza, regime warplanes struck the Deir al-Balah area, killing a number of Palestinians. 8 civilians were also killed after Israeli jets targeted a civilian vehicle near the Al-Maghazi refugee camp. In Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, a Palestinian woman was killed in an airstrike on a home. The regime's artillery also targeted several areas across Gaza, leaving an unknown number of Palestinians dead or injured. A total of nearly 39,500 Palestinians have been killed and over 91,000 injured since the regime's genocide started last October. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war has worsened the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Palestinians there are facing hunger and disease amid lack of food and medical supplies. Let's listen to some comments by Gazans talking about the hardships that they're facing.
For how long? How much longer is this silence going to last? The silence of the Arabs, the silence of the Muslims, the silence of the world towards the suffering of the Palestinian people. What do you want? Do you want the people of Gaza to offer more than this? We have lost children, women. We gave our souls, we gave our homes, we gave our lands. What else do you want? We're steadfast. We're steadfast despite the hunger, despite the thirst, and you have seen how the people of Gaza live. That diseases are killing us on all sides. On top of the hunger, on top of the thirst, on top of the lack of shelter, it's summer, and you know what the heat of the summer is like.
300 days and the Israeli aggression continues against our country and people, despite the hunger, the deprivation, the shortages, the death and destruction. But we remain steadfast in the land of Isra and Al-Miraj.
Now, the Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has called for the establishment of a security pact in West Asia region. He made these remarks following the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. Rahshan Saglam reports.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan suggested in an interview with Turkish broadcaster Channel 7 that forming a regional security alliance in West Asia could help stabilize the area. The top diplomat said the security pact will forge a trust among regional countries and prevent unnecessary interventions from outside.
We do not want to remain a country that only sees and describes the problem in the region. We also care about bringing real, applicable solutions to them. This is not the first war, nor the last. But one thing is important. We must develop a capability and capacity to be ready for any kind of struggle.
Hakan did not specify which countries would be involved in the pact, but analysts say the potential alliance will include as many West Asian countries as possible.
I believe that forming a security alliance in the region will enhance political and military coordination among the countries of the region, which they currently lack. This is not a new idea, as we have previously heard about plans to establish an Arab or regional alliance like NATO to serve the interests of the West Asia. As for the countries involved, the minister did not mention any specific names, but I believe the alliance will aim to include as many West Asian countries as possible, especially those surrounding Palestine.
Turkey is already part of a security alliance, which is US-led NATO. However, it seems that there are conflicting interests among the bloc's member states in various issues. Therefore, Ankara seems to be trying to initiate new alliances.
I don't think the regional security alliance would affect NATO, as each alliance has its own geographic scope and specific objectives.
Turkey has been recently making concerted effort to strengthen ties with regional countries. This was evident from Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's latest meetings with high-ranking regional officials, including from Iran and Egypt. He also called for a meeting with his Syrian counterpart after years of severed ties. Last week, Turkish Foreign Minister said Ankara is seeking stronger ties with Arab countries, including Syria and Egypt. It appears that Turkey is now focusing on strengthening ties with regional countries instead of seeking Western acceptance of its role as a regional power. Rahshan Saglam, Istanbul.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
Biden's humiliating withdrawal from the presidential selection process once again confirmed beyond reasonable doubt that money is the fuel that drives America's political engine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, Joe Biden's humiliating withdrawal from the presidential selection process has exposed two things about the decaying U.S. political system. One is positive, the other negative. On the positive side, it showed that the U.S. is still a system, although decaying rapidly. The American political caste, masquerading as a democracy, understood that to save the imperialist regime, it would have to take a very embarrassing and risky step. Why was Biden's withdrawal embarrassing? It proved that, for the past 2 years, the unhinged Trumpist camp was telling the truth. That truth was that Joe Biden was incapable of carrying out his duties as president. Imagine a state or political system where Donald Trump's camp is considered credible. The risk of Biden's withdrawal is quite clear. The entire machinery of the U.S. ruling establishment must now reframe its message, strategy, and tactics. This will not only create obstacles for the current ruling regime in Washington, but also the Trumpists. Trump's camp had framed its entire campaign strategy on Biden's incompetence. This will now have to undergo drastic readjustment. Nevertheless, in general terms, Trump's team will be able to maintain its overall approach, as Kamala Harris is very closely associated with brand Biden. Another important feature revealed by Biden's withdrawal is that public statements of U.S. politicians must never be taken at face value. A few days prior to announcing his withdrawal, Biden was assuring the public that he will be staying in the presidential race no matter what. Biden's withdrawal once again confirmed beyond reasonable doubt that money is the fuel that drives America's political engine. While both Trump and Harris will be competing for money, and that's what makes or breaks presidential campaigns, there are some external dynamics which show that, at least in symbolic terms, the Trump candidacy has access to global coffers. For example, Saudi-linked media outlets quite clearly began mocking Kamala Harris. It is no longer the case that only Washington has the capability to influence political processes in other countries. Others, including the despotic regimes the U.S. has installed and supported abroad, now influence events inside America as well. The recent resignation of U.S. Senator Bob Menendez, who had accepted bribe money from the Egyptian junta, thus exposing his close ties to it, is one of many examples. American politics have entered the uncharted territory as its decades-old duopoly has malfunctioned at a time when other countries are openly challenging the U.S. globally and in almost every domain. What Americans do internally is of no concern to the rest of the world. But since the U.S. is a global imperialist regime, America's politics, especially power transfer in Washington, affects other parts of the world as well. Trump and Harris regimes, whoever gets into power, will create their own set of problems for the rest of the world. At the moment, Harris' presidency appears more problematic, as it will provide the United States with a civilized mask to continue its aggressive policies abroad. Although Trump's future regime is likely to do greater tangible harm, as he lacks statesmanship skills, America under his presidency will be much more detested than under Harris in mobilizing the wider world against its despotism. Meanwhile, American news agency wrote, the U.S. Democratic Party has pulled off the first coup in U.S. history by forcing President Joe Biden to withdraw from the upcoming election. Presidential candidate Donald Trump said, Donald Trump told Fox News, according to TASS, they, the Democrats, staged a coup against the President of the United States. They went to him and told him, you are leaving, you are way down in the poll. The former head of state added that this was a coup, the first one of the presidents of the United States. The U.S. presidential election will be held on November 5th. The Democratic Party was supposed to be represented by Joe Biden, but after his failed performance in the June debate with Trump, calls for the incumbent head of state to give up the fight grew louder among Democrats. On July 21st, he decided to withdraw from the race and endorse Harris for the state's top office.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Years after every internal event or presidential election, the West, its allies, and agents in the region and beyond have bet on the future of the Iranian Islamic Revolution, which has so far defied all internal and external calculations. This revolution has proven itself once again after the election of reformer Masoud Pezeshkian as president, demonstrating its ideological and political maturity despite all the dangers it has faced over the years. The message sent by President-elect Pezeshkian to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, addressing him first even before taking office, aimed to show the entire world that the revolution remains steadfast and any bets against its principles are bound to fail now and always. President Pezeshkian's second message to the head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, reaffirmed the unwavering stance of the Iranian Revolution in supporting the central cause for all Arabs and Muslims, which is Palestine. The phone calls between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Russian President Putin, and Chinese President Xi Jinping with President-elect Pezeshkian came to confirm the continuation of Tehran's strategic approach in its relations with its allies. Without them, Iran would have been in a tougher situation. And without Iran, they would have also been in a difficult position, especially at this stage facing complex and serious regional and international challenges due to the situation in Ukraine, the imperialist colonial Zionist conspiracy against the Palestinian people with their divine patience. As for Western diplomatic circles, they expect, even wish, for President Pezeshkian to open channels of dialogue with Washington and Western capitals, as he promised during the election campaign, aiming to return to the nuclear agreement. They suggest that Washington will require Pezeshkian to show some lukewarmness in Iran's relations with both Beijing and Moscow, forgetting that it was President Trump who withdrew from the nuclear agreement, not Tehran. It was Tehran that faced hostility from Washington because it resisted and thwarted the imperialist West's plans during the so-called Arab Spring years. If those plans had succeeded, Iran would have also found itself in an undesirable situation due to the conspiracies of the imperialist West and its allies in the region. Regardless of the speculation about Iran's future policies under its new president, one thing remains evident. Imperialist, colonial, and Zionist agendas persist in manipulating Arab and Islamic public opinion. These forces continue to sideline critical issues that have long been the primary source of suffering for the region's peoples. Meanwhile, Iran will continue to support the peoples of the region to attain full liberation from the fangs of imperialism and Zionist colonialism. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The state and government in Iran have proven that they operate within an institutional framework. What the regime strives for is a strong state with influence beyond its borders and the ability to adapt for its interests. But will President Pezeshkian bring about radical changes? To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Mr. Tara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Satara. Now, amidst regional conflict and political upheaval, Iran's political system has demonstrated stability by actually electing President Pezeshkian. But the main question asked everywhere, especially on hostile Western mainstream media, is are there any radical changes with Iranian President Pezeshkian taking power?
Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, Iran has been very stable in the stability during even the things that happened after the passing away of our president, our foreign minister, and the other officials shows that Iran has a strong political system that does not that is not affected easily by the events in the not only in the region but also in the country. I think for any country that has a strongly established system does not witness radical changes when the heads of the governments change, because there is a framework, there is a basis, a foundation, a strong foundation that the executive powers as well as the other branches of the power work within that frame and based on that foundation. So while certain things are going to be very different with regards to both foreign policy and domestic policy, we're not going to see radical changes because Iran is a stable country with a very well-established political system. And, you know, we had a snap election. We lost our president, our foreign minister. This was chaos enough for many countries to go through. But for Iran, we had a very peaceful transition of power, and which is still going on. And we held our elections for two different rounds. And the country elected their new president.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Sattariya, we did see that Mr. President Pezeshkian reaffirming the strong stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran beside regional resistance factions, namely Hezbollah and Hamas, which really is the very big concern for the West right here. They want to support both Hamas and Hezbollah in their fight against Zionist Israel, and they want to stick to that support. Did the Iranian public ever doubt during this transitional period that this will be the case with the soon-adopted foreign policy, that they will shift maybe, or that they knew that their government will just stick to its foreign policy?
Well, the majority of the people know that this is one of the main principles of Iran's foreign policy, and the Iran's support for resistance will never be wavered. It's going to continue no matter who becomes the president, because all these presidents believe on those principles that the country upholds. So I think the majority of people knew, and there were no doubts about it, but their concerns may be about how the new president is going to establish alliances and relations with the other countries in the region that would, in a way, affect Iran's support for the resistance groups. But whether or not Iran would continue to support the resistance groups was never a question. And mm-hmm. That's a given fact that we all know about Iran's foreign policy.
I think the main issue was that President Pezeshkian is a reformist, and we did see many, he's the third reformist president, if I'm not mistaken, and we did see reformist presidents before him who continued to support. Nonetheless, even the support was greater at some point, militarily I speak, because it was during the years of the global war in Syria. So in that particular case, is there public support for it, or some people would like to see less of that support?
This is what the majority of the people want, because it's not only that we're offering support for another country of our, which is our friend. It's also a part of Iran's national security. Israel is not a threat only to those resistant groups and the countries of the region, but also a big threat to Iran's national security. And I mean, it tries to be, at least. And we see that as a form of repelling the threats by Israel. I mean, Israel has been trying to create chaos and attack and assassinate, and there's a long list and record of hostility towards Iran, and Iran's alliance with the regional countries and support for resistance groups is just part of that, that the people want to stay, and that's a part of our national security that people want to see continued.
Mm-hmm. Well, with Mr. Masoud Pezeshkian's presidency, what do you think are the prospects and challenges of for the Islamic Republic of Iran in potentially maybe trying to return to the JCPOA nuclear agreement? I mean, how might this administration approach negotiations with the international community in the event Trump again is to become a president, and he's the one who actually withdrew from the JCPOA to begin with? If he's back in the White House, what kind of strategy does President Pezeshkian has to approach this negotiation?
Well, when Mr. Pezeshkian was the member of parliament, in a speech he at the parliament, he mentioned that we cannot expect the U.S. to return, and we cannot trust the U.S. because it has once violated and breached its commitments to the deal. But during the campaigns, and that's what Iran has been doing, he mentioned that we need to find a way and work on, towards removing the sanctions in order to bring some economic ease to the country, because as that's the answer to your question with regards to what are the main challenges. One of the main challenges of the Islamic Republic right now and the new president is solving the economic issues and problems that the country is going through. And as a part of working towards that, Mr. Pezeshkian suggested that he's going to work towards removing getting the deal and returning to the JCPOA and removing the sanctions. However, we need to know that right now and for the past months, there is a negotiation team by late President Mr. Raisi that has been working on confidential negotiations through Oman to see how or if it's possible for the U.S. to return to the deal. And they're working with the other European and with China and Russia, the now formerly 5+1, but now 4+1 group. They're working to see what is the mechanism, what are the procedures to revive the JCPOA. But to be honest, it looks like the U.S. has no intention and is dragging its feet. So this is going to be a main challenge, reviving the JCPOA without the U.S. And making sure that the European partners will actually stay or abide by their commitments, because they also failed. I mean, the U.S. withdrew, but the European partners of the deal also failed to abide by their commitments. So this is going to be a main challenge on the foreign policy, especially that has been promised to the people that he's going to work towards that, and that's going to bring about some major changes in the economic situation of the country.
In 1 minute, if that doesn't work, what other plan does Mr. Pezeshkian have?
Well, I think by now, because we have the experience of trying to reach a deal in the first place, and then seeing Trump withdrawing from the U.S. withdrawing from the deal, now the president-elect has a more he's relying more on domestic capabilities and on forming alliances with other countries. That's also what he has mentioned, that he's not going to focus on only forming alliances or reaching a deal with the West. He's going to work with Eastern partners and partners from the global South to see how it could help with developing Iran's economy and bringing about more economic ease.
Well, Sitara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast, thanks a million for being with us to explain how things are going after the election of the new president, Mr. Pezeshkian. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the shattered Zionist economy.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Thousand Israeli businesses have been forced to shut as a result of the ongoing war and its devastating effect on the economy. Hebrew newspaper Maariv reported on 10th of July, referring to Zionist Israel as a country in collapse. More details in the following report.
Since the genocidal war in Gaza began, thousands of businesses have shut down in Zionist Israel, intensifying the economic crisis in the occupation entity. Zionist Israeli Kofas BDI, a company specializing in business information and credit risk management, reports that since October 7, 46,000 Israeli entity businesses have closed their doors. Yoel Amir, CEO of Kofas BDI, explained to Maariv, a Zionist daily newspaper, that this high number spans many sectors. About 77% of these closures, roughly 35,000 businesses, are small enterprises with up to 5 employees. According to Kofas BDI's risk rating, widely used by companies in the Israeli entity economy, including the banking system and international credit insurance companies, the construction industry and its ecosystem, ceramics, air conditioning, aluminum, and building materials are the most vulnerable. The report estimates that by the end of 2024, around 60,000 businesses in Zionist Israel may close. The crate sector encompassing fashion, footwear, furniture, housewares, and services like cafes, entertainment, leisure, and transportation has been hit hard. Additionally, the tourism industry is suffering from almost no foreign visitors, worsened by declining national morale and tourist areas now resembling combat zones. The agriculture sector, predominantly located in confrontation areas in the south and north, also faces manpower shortages. The economic damage is extensive. When companies shut down and fail to meet their financial obligations, the effects ripple out to impact customers, suppliers, and others within their ecosystem. Since the beginning of 2024, the Israeli regime's budget has recorded a cumulative deficit of 26 billion shekels, equivalent to about $7 billion. According to Maariv, the monthly budget deficit in March alone reached 15 billion shekels, or about $4 billion, equating to 6.2% of the GDP. Moreover, the war has pushed Zionist Israel's debt to record levels since October 2023, reaching $43 billion by April 2024, a figure that has doubled according to the Ministry of Finance of the entity. According to the data released by the Bank of Israel in late April 2024, Zionist Israel's war on the Gaza Strip has cost the occupation at least $67 billion so far.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hassan Younis. He is an expert in economy, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and educational leadership. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Younis. Now, how does the closure of 46,000 businesses since the beginning of the war impact the long-term economic stability of Zionist Israel?
Yep. Thanks a lot for hosting me, Dr. Marwa. Actually, when we talk about the genocidal Israeli war on Gaza, we can't only take the aspect of what's happening in the battlefield or the military aspect. There is a war of narratives, and the resistance movements are having the upper hand in the war of narratives. The Israeli movements are having the upper hand in the military field, and apparently the resistance movements are having the upper hand from an economic perspective. What's happening in Israel is definitely an economic collapse. We have witnessed a slow growth in the economy. There are 46 businesses closing. The number is expected to grow to reach 60,000 businesses by the end of the year. This has a great impact on all the economic indications in the country, talking about inflation, recession, talking about the ability of the Israeli regime to attract capital. We are witnessing capital flight because the appetite of the international donors is decreasing. The creditworthiness of Israel or the Israeli entity is diminishing to a record level. So the ranking of the Israeli economy has an impact on its credit worthiness. And the 46 businesses which are closing are from different sectors, from all the sectors that you can imagine. And mostly they are small and medium enterprises. And these SMEs or small and medium enterprises, they are the backbone of any economy. So entrepreneurs are not investing in Israel, and the big donors are not sending enough capital to Israel. And if they are sending these gifts or donations are not invested in the right sectors. They are invested in immediate relief and not in infrastructural projects which are highly needed in Israel. And they are only for expenditure purposes and not for reinvesting purposes. Mm-hmm. These indicators are very negative in any economy. They are the indicators of developing countries rather than developed countries. And Israel always claims to be a developed country. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about business closures. We are talking about diversion of governmental spending. We are talking about decrease in the foreign investment, the hesitancy of the developed countries to invest in Israel. Definitely they are hesitant because of this war. Usually when we talk about any organization, and I perceive a country or an entity as an organization, we usually talk about the goodwill. Israel is witnessing an unprecedented ill will This ill will is due to the bad reputation. In addition to the military aspect, the bad reputation due to the war of narratives decreases the appetite of investment and decreases the propensity of the major countries to invest or send money to Israel.
Something quite interesting, Dr. Yunus, is that the substantial war expenditure has significantly increased Zionist Israel's debt, reaching record levels with a $67 billion war expenditure so far. How do you think that that will be translated on Zionist Israel's internal fiscal health and probably also international credit standing?
Yeah. So the impact of this number, the $67 billion, is not only the $67 billion, which is huge and which is unprecedented. The problem is in the credit ranking or credit rating. Israel will face difficulties in getting credits or getting gifts or getting donations in the future. And even if they want to borrow money, the propensity of the international organizations to lend Israel money will decrease substantially due to this problem in credit rating. And these economic problems, in addition to the military problems they are facing, have an impact on different levels. For instance, around the number of expected tourists to Israel was supposed to be 1 million. And they've received only 200,000 tourists. So a substantial decrease in 80%. And usually such countries rely on the expenditures of tourists to give an injection to the economy. In the contrary, these numbers, we're not witnessing them in Lebanon. The number of tourists in Lebanon and the number of the Lebanese, the diaspora, coming back to Lebanon
is increasing substantially. Far more, it's increasing than the years before.
It's increasing substantially. So when I want to compare figures from the different aspects, military, economically, tourists-wise, narratives-wise, the upper hand is always being to the resistance movements, as you can see, Marwa.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Yunus, expert in economics, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and education leadership. It's always a pleasure seeing you and talking to you. Hopefully, we talk when liberation happens and we start talking about how the economy of Palestine will pick up, inshallah. Thanks a million for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do stay tuned on the Middle East stream next week for more updates. A'adham Allah ajrukum bi musab Aba Abdullah Hussein for the calamity that befell on Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein in Karbala. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoints, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to choose some of the movies with religious and spiritual themes to criticize, not necessarily artistically speaking. My two friends and critiques and guests, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the studio.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you.
The pleasure is always mine. Well, one of those movies that we decided on criticizing is called Morgan, which was produced in 2016, directed by Lucas Scott. It features actors and actresses such as Kate Mara, Anya Taylor-Joy, Paul Giamatti, to just name a few. The budget for this movie was $8 million, whereas the box office was $8.8 million. IMDb gave it a 5.8 out of 10, and Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 30% approval rating, and also Film Affinity a 5.2 out of 10. This is about, scientists, the whole plot revolves around this theme. The scientists at a research company discovered that Morgan, the human hybrid they are working on, has a vicious side. However, before she can be contained, she kills the researchers and escapes. Well, let's take a short break by listening to trailer of this movie, Morgan, directed by Lucas Scott, produced in 2016. And then we'll be back and continue the program Viewpoints on RIB English Radio.
Amy!
Don't go in there!
Oh my God. We're all very happy to have you here, Lee.
I imagine that's not exactly true.
Doctor?
This is Lee Weathers from corporate.
I'm just looking for some information about Morgan.
Morgan was our third attempt, our little breakthrough. It's the next step in evolution. It's bioengineered with synthetic DNA. Within a month, walking and talking. Within 6 months, it exceeded our wildest expectations.
I'd like to discuss the incident, if that's okay.
Back to the program, Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser. Syed Abdullah, let me start with you in this episode. What do you think of this movie, Morgan?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know me, like when it comes to movies, I'm very picky, really picky. This one was quite boring for me. They had a good concept. They had a good idea, but they were very quick to kill it before it starts. Like, there was no build up to the movie. There is, I know they began with a violent scene, but it's still like the viewer doesn't even know what's going on. Mm. There is no character build up. There is no character growth. There's a character, he's, whether it's good or